Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today's episode of the show is sponsored by our friends at Brooklady, the award-winning whiskey from Islay, who we have partnered with here at Hodinkee for the last couple of years. Stay tuned for an update later in the show on what we're up to this season. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, back at the helm of another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today, we thought it would be fun to look back at 2024. This is actually going to be sort of a two-part series, which we're pretty excited about. The first one, I'm joined by Tantan Wang, our editor, and Malika Crawford, our style editor. And the goal today, like I said, is just basically to look back on the last year, do a little bit of like a retrospective. I'm going to do the same sort of episode again with Mark and Rich, which you will see in part two. But I really enjoy this time of year because you do get to kind of look back and go like, oh, that did happen in 2024. Or, oh, I entirely forgot about that. Or I was so tired when that happened, I ignored it. And sometimes you find some new moments and sometimes you get to discover that people went a lot deeper than you thought. I always enjoy kind of how all of Watch Media kind of starts to look back at the year right around November and December. And we're recording this just before American Thanksgiving. So should be in a pretty good mood. We've almost got a couple days off here and it's always fun to do more Hodinkee Radio. So welcome Tantan. Welcome Malika. How are we doing?
Doing pretty good. I'm hungry. I'm ready for some Thanksgiving food. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then a good nap. It's one of my favorite naps of the year, to be clear. I do rank naps, and it's a top player. Major.
James,
player.
Are you a chunky cranberry sauce guy or the smooth one from the can kind of guy?
I'm kind of indifferent to cranberry sauce. I'll dabble, but I don't think I have an opinion on the viscosity or texture therein.
Oh, cool.
How about you?
I'm chunky cranberry sauce all the way, but I know
that's how I am with peanut butter. So maybe I got to give it a better run.
Think so. Malika? It's underrated.
Cranberry sauce.
I don't really care, to be honest.
What's the anchor of your Thanksgiving plate?
Well, to be fair, I'm not really an expert on Thanksgiving, just given my sort of background and birthplace. But I do like a little bit of. I'm going to just say that I prefer an English Sunday roast to Thanksgiving dinner. And I think that's fair for me to say.
I'll be
like
honest,
a Yorkshire pudding kind of thing.
Anytime I see Yorkshire pudding, I'm not upset.
Like, you can't be a Sunday roast with a giant Yorkshire pudding and layers of gravy and roast potatoes. Yeah. You just can't. It's the only thing we can do. It's our national dish.
So I've got a question for you. Is this sacrilege? I have a buddy also of English descent, and he would make. For fun, I used to live down the street from him, and he would make entire like muffin tins of Yorkshire puddings, each one with gravy, a little bit of roast beef, a scoop of mashed potatoes, and like some horseradish. And we used to really go to town on those.
That's absolutely classic. It sounds delicious. Yeah, love that. Okay,
really good. Well, this is what people came here for sure. An in-depth discussion of roast beef technology and you know whether or not Thanksgiving can hold a candle to the English supper. I like it. That's good. But no, let's try and dial it in here a little bit as we start sort of our end of year series. We'll have lots of stories like we always do and kind of look backs and think pieces and the rest of it. But I did want to kick it off with a nice little chat about what 2024 was, because I think it was a pretty strange year in watches.
It was really bizarre. And I admitted on this call, and I'm just going to say it publicly, that post Watches and Wonders, I sort of blacked out this year, I feel, with new releases. I can barely remember any of them.
I think that's fair. Look, I think let's start as broadly as we possibly can. Yeah. In your mind, did 2024 have a theme? Like 2024 was the year of the...
Mini.
So really smaller stuff?
For me, it was the year of the mini because that's what I paid attention to. And then I also made a list of everything that was mini, and it was quite long. I got AP Royal Oak Mini, Cartier Tank LC Mini, American Mini, Longines Mini, BB Bulgari Mini. There were just a lot of minis. So that's where I'm at. But obviously, you guys might be at a different headspace.
I did have a note in prep for this that it seemed like the mini trend might actually be an interesting piece of like Cartier is so popular right now that they're actually propping up other brands lines that haven't been that popular. Like, I think you look at the Longines Dolce Vita, which I think is quite a really good watch, but a quiet watch. It's not a watch that like garnered a lot of insane enthusiasm from collectors, but I think it's having a moment. And I think it's because like Cartier's moment has become so big that it's starting to like bleed into anything that could be comparable.
This is quite a hot take, and I'm not here to diss anybody, but like nobody is calling out the elephant in the room here of the Bernard. The success of that watch is like obviously a trickle down from like Cartier crash mania. I'm not saying it's a derivative. I'm just saying I think you're right in that Cartier's influence is just so widespread.
Like I don't think we're at the apex of this concept, but think about it like 60s Rolex suddenly got crazy. Like it was always popular and there were always people who liked it, like Cartier, but it got insanely popular like what, 2010? And then it just, nobody could see the top of where it was going. And it spawned so many vintage Submariner similar watches, like an entire industry of micro brand watches that were, you know, maybe they looked a little bit, just enough like a Comex, or just enough like a Milsub, or just enough like some other reference. And I think we might be on the starting wave of seeing that from the world of Cartier, and like with the Bernard being an example.
For sure.
Maybe we're not there yet.
I feel like we're on our way there.
Tintin, what do you figure with these watches? These sort of the we'll call it the Cartier effect, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I feel like this year, I think this ties into my answer about just 2024 in general. Like it feels like sort of like a cautionary year. I think brands are sort of stuck in this middle space where they're not sure whether or not, I mean, we've seen sales like drop pretty dramatically from a lot of the sort of publicly, traded groups out there. And I think brands aren't sure whether or not to kind of take this moment to introduce bonkers stuff to try to, you know, revitalize their assortment, or sort of play it safe and kind of keep drilling down on the stuff that works, right? And so for me, this kind of mini thing is cool because it kind of feels like a little bit in between. A lot of the sort of smaller stuff are riffs on kind of mainstays and icons, but then you have the twist is the sort of smaller size, which then appeals to a whole new sort of clientele. So I think for me, that's a way that I feel like brands are responding this year in trying to kind of play it safe, yet sort of, you know, have some really cool story to say. I think for me, it's uncertainty. Yeah.
Do we think small is playing it safe? Do we think mini is playing it safe?
I don't think so. But I think at the same time, it's one of those things where because Cartier has done it already, because I think we already saw the trend start in previous years, that it's definitely not the most innovative thing this year, right? It's not
I've decided where I stand on men and small watches.
Uh-huh. Let's hear it.
Because why not just let everybody know how I feel?
It's a podcast, so.
It's a podcast and, you know, I can't keep my mouth shut. So I think the men in small watches thing kind of gets on my nerves, to be honest. But I think it's cool.
Is it too much of an affect?
Oh, it's just like, okay, we get it.
And how small are we talking?
Honestly, like, I think it would be below 33. Okay. I think 33 and above, like I think you could do a 33 to 36 dress watch and it's not really a big deal.
Yeah. I'm wearing a 36 mil watch now. I have a 33.5 from Seiko, a line that they make in Japan, which is awesome. The Dolce, they make a little tiny, it looks a little bit like a Grand Seiko, has this gorgeous dial. And I picked one up from Japan a little while ago, and they're just really fun to wear. It's like 6 millimeters thick. That's so cool. Yeah.
Like a Don Draper 1950s dress watch slipped under the cuff.
But like that, me wearing my wife's 26 millimeter Panther, too far.
Yeah, I just
we didn't need two bracelets. I think, but
like we just like I just can't. I just unless you're like the kind of guy that really has the steez, you know. But sure. I was talking to my friend about this, and we were just like, it's cool when you're kind of wearing an elegant outfit. So if you're wearing a suit or like something she can put together, sure, wear a teeny tiny. But if you're just like wearing some full on like fit and you're trying to be like a fit god, please, like the small watch thing just gets on my nerves.
So in contrast, what if you are a fit god, what should be on your wrist?
Wear like a sub. I think that's kind of cool. Just Malaika
Crawford recommending a sub. That's like, that's new.
Like, wear like, I don't know, wear like lean into the kind of sportiness because I like the contrast. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
Like,
I think so.
If you, I don't know. It's just like if you're a big guy and you got a big wrist, wear a big watch. I don't know.
Yeah. I like that.
Hot takes.
There you
go. Hot takes. Not so hot.
Again, special thanks to our partners at Brooklady for the support of Hoodinky Radio. This holiday season, we've partnered with Brooklady on a special giveaway that you can learn all about in the link in the article below or in the notes for this episode. You might be surprised at what you see, and you most definitely don't want to miss it. And now, back to the show. So, I want us to imagine back to the fantastical realm of Watches and Wonders 2024, which I think we all said it on various podcasts and other pieces of feedback that it felt like a slow year, like maybe a building year or a quiet year. And I don't know, like you look back at the year and there was definitely some stuff that came out. But I would agree, like if you compare 24 to 23, definitely a quieter year for especially Rolex. And we're definitely going to do some episodes that'll come out later in December about 2025 and what we're kind of hoping, thinking will show up and that sort of thing. But do you think the sort of feeling of it being a down year lived out through the whole year, or did we start kind of down and trend upwards as far as hype, interest, you know, big releases, that sort of thing?
I honestly don't feel, I mean, just, you know, based on pure gut feeling, like Malaika said, it just like, it hasn't felt like this year I can just immediately go to a time and place. And I was like, this is where that moment happened. Right. I think like, aside from maybe controversy, let's say like with moments like the Cubitus, stuff like that, like, and to be clear, right, there've been extremely solid launches this year, but I think in the sort of spirit of where I think this year, we're also seeing a phenomenon where really solid launches are actually attainable, right? Like people can actually go into a store and buy them. You no longer have this like artificial scarcity mentality where you're like, oh, these are just like crazy concept ideas that I'm seeing, you know, and I'll never see them again. And if I do, I'll be so lucky that I must buy it. Like, no, we're in a time where, you know, I think one of the best releases this year was the White Dial Moonwatch, right? Like I bought one of those. I think it's a fantastic watch. It's the first Speedmaster that I've truly like aligned with. And I could just buy it, right? That's such a different feeling. And I think consumers are responding accordingly as well, where they're like, well, if things like this I can start buying, you know, maybe I don't need to snap up everything in a frenzy. And I think brands are realizing that now and they have to kind of take a step back. So I think it's all timed a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, looking over the notes and trying to prep for this, I did kind of get the feeling that Omega had a quietly killer year. They kept their head down and they came out with a handful of watches that people are actually excited about that you can buy. And I think enthusiasts, when Omega threads the needle, so to speak, enthusiasts get really excited because you can buy it. You might have to wait. Look, if you walk into a big retailer now and ask for the White Dial Speedy, you might have to wait a little bit, but not years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to pay a bunch of ADM. Like
everyone's just like,
watch.
You will get this watch. Like their response is always, you will get it. It's not, oh, maybe we'll consider you. Maybe no. It's like, you just wait, just be patient and you'll get it.
Yeah, it was like a kind of a subtle, cool year for Omega. And we get a little bit more into it, but I did want to get Malaika's take on whether or not the year stayed low or kind of sneaky, had some of these hits like the White Dial Speedy.
I feel like this year is giving normcore. Okay. Like,
I agree.
Back to like a little bit of like a back to basics almost.
I agree.
Like, honestly, which I'm here for it because it's like a palate cleanse and it's also a reflection of these quite turbulent times in the economy and politically. I think we're just keeping it safe. I would say it's like that in other industries too. Like everything feels a bit normcore, but I reckon when things get normcore and like, I need to stop saying that word. Maybe
define it just in case people don't understand how watches would relate to normcore.
Normcore is just like kind of the basic, you know, in terms of, let me think, like fashion wise, it would be like a pair of blue jeans and a white t-shirt.
Yeah, it's like the gap in the late 90s.
Yeah, it's like a pair of, you know, New Balance sneakers, mm-hmm. and like there's nothing wrong with that. It's Jerry Seinfeld. And yeah. Sometimes you can lean into that and it's kind mm-hmm. of cool in its own way, right? Just like I'm slowly being won over. Don't tell anybody this, but I'm slowly being won over by the Speedmaster, by the Moonwatch.
Yeah.
Which I think is like the definitive normcore watch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because all men love it. I'm sorry. And I don't really know that many women who love it, but all men love that watch. It's so crazy to me.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with that because I always sort of felt on the outskirts because the Speedmaster was a thing that was sort of, and you know, Hodinkee had a large part of this. The Speedmaster is shoved down your throat as sort of,
oh my God,
24/7. You must love this. And here's my qualifying statement. I bought an 1861. I did not jive with it. I sold it after a year. I bought the 3861 because I was like, this is the perfect moonwatch, right? This is everything I wanted, the modern one.
It is. I mean, and on paper, it is.
On paper, it is. It checks all the boxes. Just didn't jive with it. And then the white dial one. I sold that one. White dial one came out and I was like, this one's a keeper. And so for me, like I went through that whole thing and it kind of, I felt almost guilty admitting that just like I didn't get the standard moonwatch. It's good to know that there are people out there that.
Yeah,
you know, I don't get it. James probably loves it.
No, I've been a long time outlier that it doesn't work on my wrist.
Interesting.
I like the vintage stuff is quite fun because if they genuinely feel like when you get a chance to see an old Eames chair, like a true late 60s Speedy with some age on it is a gorgeous thing. It is like looking at a piece of mid-century perfection as far as design. But I'm pretty obviously not a huge chronograph guy to begin with. I like dive watches, I like GMTs for the most part, like for the day to day. And that's where Speedy shines. It's as an everyday watch. They're gorgeous. They look really good. They're so well made these days. Great tech in the movement, all that kind of stuff. And I think the white one definitely speaks to me. I'm a sucker for a white dial for sure. And they do a really, like Omega makes an incredible dial. They're just really good at it on an otherwise... you know, maybe run of the mill sports watch, which Omega should be good at making, they can still add some excitement via the dial. And I think they do a good job there. And then look, I'm a sucker for the gold ones. Changes the whole thing for me.
See, I'm not into the gold. I'm not into the gold. No.
Not the green dial?
Okay, hear me
no
out.
No moonshine
because,
for you?
Because I don't think Omega is a luxury product.
Oh,
and,
whoa. Okay.
Yeah, and like, just as I don't think people are going to hate this, but this is my opinion. I don't think Rolex is a luxury product. Like,
because it's a question of being too many are made or.
Not just that, but like
thing.
Just the DNA of like, it's a sports watch. It's supposed to be a utilitarian.
Okay.
It's like, you know, that was always, you know, yes, it's a luxury product, but it comes in like at a middle price point, right? Unless we're talking about Le Mans and all of that,
sure,
1908 stuff, which is them doing something different. But like,
and, I mean, Omega does a ton of stuff up into the 40s, 50s, 60s, platinums and white golds.
But
and
like
kind of stuff.
The core product, like, you know, Rolex Professional and then, you know, Seamasters, Speedmasters, like that to me is, yes, it's a nice product and it's a little bit expensive, but it's not like quote unquote luxury. It's not Patek Philippe. It's not Haute Horologie. And so to me, the Speedmaster as the definitive normcore watch, like that is how I see a stainless steel Speedmaster and I don't really see anything beyond that. But that's just my take. Like, and I could see how someone would be into that green dial gold.
Yeah. I mean, I like that one with the champagne dial, the black subdials on the rubber, especially. But I would on the bracelet is something else. The modern tapered bracelet, which I know is also done in steel on the white, is just that bracelet's excellent.
Can I ask you though, if someone was like, Here's a gold Speedmaster and here's a gold Daytona. I mean, what are you picking?
It would depend on which Daytona. One.
Really?
I'm picking a Daytona. I think the Speedmaster is one of those things where like that moonshine gold is so beautiful, but it's one of those things where I'm almost like happy to just look at, you know, and happy to wear and try on from someone else. But it's never something that I'm like, that's something I need. And that's like a hard balance, I think, to strike in a product.
Another definitive normcore watch is the Rolex Explorer one, which I wear almost every day.
Great watch.
Great watch. I feel like I'm really leaning into those kinds of sort of just staples, very kind of easy to wear, classic design, nothing too crazy. I'm into it.
So, Malaika, to you, Rolex is defined by the professional line. That's the sort of...
That's what you see on everyone's wrist.
So then in that kind of context, would you say like the Day-Date, that's like a luxury product being made by a brand that's not necessarily like majority luxury or defined by a luxury image?
Rolex is ubiquitous for sure. But like to me, when you say the word luxury, I'm in a totally different headspace. Like, yes, the Day-Date is a luxury product for sure. A full gold watch is like a luxury watch, but like Rolex's brand identity obviously is very linked to the Day-Date. But like in my mind, what you see everywhere is like a sub or, you know, a GMT. Like that's the ubiquity.
Yeah, but products that are like downstream of mid-century excellence.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Mid-century excellence. Like well,
it's that like can do like, yeah, we can do it. We can, you know, new ways of making cities, new ways of making cars. Ways of making, and it was this great time. And suddenly 53 pops off and we got a lot of interesting watches. Kind of hitting the scene, but we've definitely derivated, which I love. But
yes, sorry.
Let's just turn it back to what were some of either your favorite releases, or if everyone's comfortable, I'm genuinely interested, and I think the audience would too. What did you buy this year that you liked? Tantan mentioned the White Speedy.
Yeah,
I was lucky enough to get a couple of things this year. Some of them actually like genuinely new.
I
thought it was a fun year for sport watches.
Tell us about your baby that you just bought there, because the most interesting one to me.
Sure. I think this is definitely a move for me. So where should I start this story? For those of you who aren't aware, just a couple days before we recorded this, or really a day before we recorded this, I took over as EIC editor-in-chief at Hodinkee. And obviously, it would be insane to not get a watch to mark the occasion. And it's Hodinkee. So, you know, I briefly talked to Tantan about Longa Ones and then realized I'd like to buy a house here in Toronto. So not a Longa One. But I did. It's Hodinkee. And I thought like a vintage Rolex is almost certainly the move. It's part of like the DNA of why Hodinkee started. And I own and love, and really I love it so much that it's kind of, it pads down my interest in having more Rolexes. But I have an Explorer 2 that I adore, a 16570. I wear it a ton. And I wanted something that, if you guys understand, and when I say the watch, I think, but maybe you two will agree or disagree, I wanted the character of that watch, but something actually almost dressy. And then at UBS, our colleague Rich Forden asked me and our whole panel in front of a big crowd, like, what was the last watch you bought that wasn't a sport watch? And like, I could not remember. I had to go back, and it was like a late 50s chronograph Swiss. Was probably the last thing that I bought, which is the little rose gold chronograph, which I wear and I enjoy. But yeah, I mostly buy sport watches. So bearing the lead here, but I was able to ask my buddy James Lambden at Analog Shift for this rather lovely 1601 linen
dial.
We
love it.
Incredible.
So this is from the early 70s. I think they told me 73. It's got drilled lugs. It's got a Sigma dial, so you get white gold markers, that sort of thing. And it's not a watch that I talk a ton about, but for my wife and I, it's one that's always been on like the co-buy radar, because perfect watch to share. I'll buy a second bracelet, so we have bracelets in two sizes. And then when it hands down, I have two daughters, so a 36 millimeter watch that could be worn with anything is a much nicer thing to hand down than one of my 200 dive watches. You know what I mean?
Like, hang on. That is quite romantic, buying two bracelets.
I never knew that.
Oh, it's the move.
Yeah, oh my
for
God.
Sure.
I'm just, Wow, that's quite
emotional. And then you can get the clasp engraved with an initial, and then you know which bracelet's which.
Oh, wait, it's a
really nice move, especially with a watch that's got drilled lugs. Like in 20 seconds, like she can pick the watch up, throw her bracelet on it, and keep going.
That's a gentleman, Mr. Stacy, you are.
I have and my, they say chivalry my moments, is dead, I suppose. Huh? But that's what I got. That's what I got to celebrate the new role, and I really like it, and I'm excited to get it engraved. And right now it hasn't really left my wrist, but it is just on the actual fancy side of the way I wear my watches with the Sigma dial. But I like the deeply monochromatic. Like as far as the 4 digit date just go, this is my favorite reference. I've just been a fan for a long time, so very lucky to have gotten that. But obviously, not even remotely a watch close to this year or a decade or this century for that matter. Just to kick it off, what I did buy this year, and from the moment I saw it, I knew I was buying one. And I think this is also like Tantan goes down this route where you see a watch and you go like, no, that's mine. Yeah. Not today, not tomorrow, but soon. It was my Doxa Sub 200, which for a $1,500 watch, find me one that's more fun. That's all I'm asking. Are there better? Can you get a great dive watch for $600 right now? Absolutely. So you don't have to spend $1,500, but I don't think you can have more fun or again, buy a watch that could be worn by basically any wrist. It's 39. I would say it wears like 37. I brought the Diving Star, which is bright yellow, which is super fun.
I love that.
I have an Autodromo, which I also bought this year, the Group C in bright yellow.
I love that.
Yeah, oh, nice. Which is kind of fun.
Yellow's if they hit the color right, yellow's a really fun dial color.
I'm desperate for a yellow OP, to be honest. Oh, I've always wanted one of those.
So, yeah.
The behind the yellow ones?
Oh, it's so good. But I honestly, I'm quite conservative about my watch purchases. Like, I'm more of a... I've been buying clothes and
sure.
bags,
yeah, yeah.
not watches, well, which then, is probably... I mean,
if not adding to the collection, then what did you see that you actually liked this year? You and I did a little photo shoot with a pretty wild Chanel. And otherwise, I've edited photos of your wrists with just Cartiers and Cartiers and Cartiers. So they must have had an okay year too.
You know what watch I love and that I would 100% wear and that I really vouch for is the Hermes cup. Like the sports watch they made for women, because I haven't seen anybody make a sport watch that I truly believe is not a derivative of something else. And I think they are so clever the way that they do their typography and the sort of subtle shapes that they use. And it's all very well put together, as one would expect Hermes to be. And I know Tantan's an Hermes watch guy, you can appreciate.
Yeah. Everything just feels so deliberate on all of their designs, which is just so hard to honestly say in this industry. I think that's always been my bone to pick with people, is that like so many of the most watches honestly get 90% of the way there. And there's always a few things that either let me down personally or just don't seem right. And they consider things from a design perspective to the nth degree. I love it.
I think they're just confident in their execution as well.
I think it's a thoughtfulness. You meet the people from the brand and they like, we think about this and we can get into it with some of the other watches that came out this year, but more and more we see as you get a certain level of enthusiast, they see the whole checkbox of a watch in their mind. And you got to check every single one to make one that somebody wants to buy. And I feel like Hermes does a really good job of thinking of what the checklist is for their buyer and nailing it. And I think other brands get really close on one thing and then give up on and like miss on a color or something like
well,
that.
Well, for sure. I think Hermes also obviously knows its customer very well. And then in addition to that, the reason why I thought the cut was so cool was because it was kind of like their attempt at going beyond maybe their traditional reach when it comes to watches for women. It was like, okay, maybe we can like have a play on this like ubiquitous sports design and kind of go a little bit further afield. I think they're trying to bring in people who are like outside of the Hermes customer zone, which is cool. And I think they just do things with such confidence that like you just sort of believe it. You believe the vision.
For sure. Tintin, how about you? What kind of hit your radar this year, and whether you bought or didn't, what are you excited about?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we already touched on the White Dial Moonwatch. I think that thing is just still going strong. It's unabashedly modern Omega, which is what I think they really need to lean into.
Totally.
I think for me, I mean, the most significant, I've bought a few pieces, I've sold a few pieces this year, but the one that, you know, sometimes you get pieces that you're like, this is just never leaving, right? For me, it's the Hobbring Irwin piece unique that I did.
Great story, too.
I talked about that on the first episode that I was in a few weeks ago, but I mean, obviously also pretty significant in terms of timing because I basically just joined the editorial team around that time. So it was a great way to sort of bring that story into my first piece. But, you know, I think that sort of the reason why that sticks to me so much is that it sort of ties into that general theme this year, right? Where I think this year I've really enjoyed buying the stuff that doesn't feel like it's from this year. Like it's more of that like timeless stuff. It's not like, oh, I need to get it because the only time when this feels special on my wrist is because it just came out. That's why it feels cool. No, like this is the stuff that actually feels more calculated, more deliberate. And like as a consumer, exactly. As a consumer, I think I almost feel stronger in my choices because there's no sort of FOMO aspect, right, to a customer that's like, I just need to get this now.
I did buy one watch this year. I forgot. It was a Vacheron cocktail watch. I think I wore it not too long ago on the pod. That's sort of, it's very small, but the bracelet is very like solid and structured. So it kind of wears like a bangle. And then it has like tiny little diamonds around the dial. And it's from the 50s. So it's amazing. And I love it. And I like to, I think I'm more of a go all in on one as opposed to like buy lots of little, which you're a buy lots of little guy, James.
Oh, I definitely am.
What
else did I get this year that I really enjoyed? Well, that Group C Autodrome was really fun, super fun.
Yeah.
If you like a digital watch, I enjoy digital watches to some extent. And then in the same vein, digital, that the reissue or redesign of the Chronosport UDT, which is now done by Momentum, is like a $350 watch. And it's just so much fun if you like 80s action movies and like the history of the Chronosport. And that, like, this is a very nerdy watch, to be fair. And I, you know, Momentum's a Canadian brand. They're run by great people. They make a really solid product that just doesn't cost that much money, so you can have a lot of fun with it. And I, you know, sure, I think if you're into quote like actual collecting, it's vintage Vacheron, it's Lange ones, it's that kind of stuff. But I got to be honest, I just chase a buzz through this game all the time. And that I got a real good one from that UDT. That's a really fun little watch.
You know, the biggest buzz that I've gotten this year has actually been, so Unimatic did a collaboration recently with the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA.
Oh, yeah, this is great.
This is their second collaboration. So the first one they did was like their Modelo Uno Diver with like the colors of their like three different ticket color schemes. But this one, this year, they did three models. And it's very loosely based off the Distille sort of art movement. It's just, I mean, all they've really taken from it is the use of primary colors. But it's done in a way that's just like, primary colors, I feel like in watches are so, and Malaika, you probably agree with me, like sometimes it's so overdone, like to the point where it just like looks absolutely terrible. You know, I think it's always done with the intention of being whimsical and childlike, but it just like looks like shit sometimes, right? And I think the way they did it with restraint is just really, really cool. And they did three different models where they're just like three different combinations about what hands use like the different primary colors, and they kind of rotate through. But like, I saw that, and I've just like, I guess this is my Moonswatch moment this year, where I saw that, and I just like ran to sure. MoMA, like the MoMA design store, and I was like, can I see this watch? They didn't even have them out. They had to like dig through the back and like open every single box with all three for me to compare. But like,
that what color did you decide on?
So on mine, the minute hand is yellow, the hour hand is red, and then the sort of, there's like a phantom seconds hand where the tip is actually all white to blend in with the white dial, but that's blue. And cool. So for me, when I like looked at all three, the weighting of the color scheme felt the best on this one. But that thing is just, yeah, you just like, when you talked about that Momentum, I was like, yeah.
Well, in a similar vein, maybe even something that kind of sits right between the MoMA Unimatics and the UDT, I picked up an Ocean of Storm Blancpain Scuba 50. And like, sure, the to be fair, Scuba 50 was a 2023 thing, I think November 2023, about a year ago. But I got the Ocean of Storm did come out in 2024, and I picked one up while we were in Geneva for Watches and Wonders, and like I wore it a bunch for the summer. That's a really fun watch for $400. And I think at a certain price, it's got to be fun because you're not making an investment, and you're definitely not making an investment on a System 51. I like them. I enjoy them. We've done several great collabs with Swatch. But I think, you know, there's different classes of these sorts of things, and these things have to be fun. And I think Swatch still absolutely nails the fun. They did Tantan. They did more of the herring stuff this year, which you covered for us. And I think was really cool. I think one of the things I like is post pandemic craziness, we still have the ability to have fun at a lot of price points. You don't have to have Rolex money to feel like you're part of it. And I think that's one of, now that I've had a few years to like absorb the whole Moonswatch thing, and it started to calm down this year for sure. Not entirely. It's still crazy. You can buy some of them online now, all of that kind of stuff. But I think looking back on it, there's something really interesting about the fact that they were able to like light a fire at a price point that just was kind of stalling out, because Seiko had taken the Seiko 5 up to $300-$500. And I think it left this sort of vacuum where Swatch, and not just with Moonswatch or Scuba 50, but Swatch in general, started dropping, you know, cool multicolored sort of 80s chronographs, like the Le Mans reissue one.
The neon stuff. Yeah.
I think that...
The neon stuff is cool.
Yeah. And we got to have fun at every price point. Because like, it doesn't matter if you spend 50 grand, it better be fun. It better be fun at 5 grand. It better be fun at 500. It should be fun at 50.
Actually, I wear Swatch and... Weirdly, I got a baby G in pink and blue this summer.
Like one of the jelly, ones, like transparent.
Yes, they kindly sent me all three colors.
Amazing.
And I actually wore them. Like they're great vacation watches.
I really like
that colorful kind of plastic vibe when I'm on vacation. Just lean into you know the vibe.
John Mayer G-Shocks for me, like that baby blue one. Perfect vacation watch.
So much fun.
Oh my God.
I've been wearing a lot of Timex 8 laps.
Oh.
I got a whole collection going now. If you guys haven't caught them, Timex Japan does their own like 4 or 5 colorways. You can buy it through Japan. They will ship it to you. The Abu Garcia is the one I'm really, really hot on, which is it's an 8 lap, but the entire case is made out of loom. So the whole case glows.
Oh, right. Did you send that to? Yeah. Okay. I'm really into this too.
Yeah.
I just feel like
it's really
rad.
It's like $97 on sale. It's so much fun.
It's kind of like a rule where just like I can't go into a discussion without mentioning Lunga at least once. I think James can't go into a discussion and not mention that watch, which is an incredible
watch. It's just
fun.
I'm just having a good time with it.
It's awesome. It's so good.
And like I said, like, I do think like you have to make sure you're having a good time with this, because it can, this industry and the media, everybody takes it all really seriously. And that's because some of it's so expensive. And you don't want to spend $150,000 on a watch and 2 years later realize you want to spend $150,000 on something else and your first $150,000 is worth $70,000. Nobody likes that feeling. Doesn't matter if it's watches, art, cars, houses, whatever. But I do like highlighting that you can spend relatively small amounts of money in this world and still have a real good time.
Get yourself 100%. Some Indiglo.
Oh, yeah. Anything that glows in the dark, I'm pumped about. Let's go. And the case and the screen. Let's go. So much fun. But yeah, and then otherwise, like, what else kind of stands out for you guys? Did you have any, like, favorite really high-end sort of stuff?
Tantan.
Lange.
Oh, yeah.
Lange went
that makes sense.
Hard this year.
Lange went hard, and, like, I say this knowing that I'm fully well-biased and in sort of loving the brand, but I think they just, like, kicked ass because they just kept doing what they're good at. They didn't try to do anything insanely out of the box. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's being a little dismissive of the crazy stuff they released, but like, it's still stuff that you're like,
they stuck to what their core competencies for sure.
Exactly. And like, they celebrated a few anniversaries this year that I think, in my opinion, they just did extremely well. Like there's no better fan service to a group of collectors that's been done better in the past few years, I think. For me, and the price tag wise, the start of the show obviously was during Watches and Wonders. That was the Datagraph Perpetual Tour Beyond Lumen, But like to me, that's not even the thing that won. I think like the two things that won for me are the Datagraph Handwerkskunst, right? The yellow gold sort of homage to the yellow jacket, and then the Lange one in Onyx, right? that's just like a crazy bit of subtlety that explains just like what drives people to that brand. So for me, I think they just had such winning moments this year. And I don't, you know, it's, they don't do it with that much fanfare, right? In context of, you know, collaboration comes out, there's a lot more discussion on it when the Platinum Lunga one with an Onyx dial comes out. Not as much, right? It's very fervent within the sort of niche collector groups, but not sort of within the broader discussion. I think I wish it got more recognition.
It's quiet. But don't you think that is like the epitome of luxury anyway? Like it's so discreet. Like that is to me like the top end of modern watch collecting.
That's another brand that knows exactly what their actual buyers want. Not just people who love the brand like me from afar. I'll have one day if I'm lucky, if I'm successful, whatever. But just even like you can appreciate Lange for what they are. But if you're a collector, it really feels like that brand speaks to people who actually buy their watches. And when you meet the people who run the brand, they're obsessed with their customers. They're really good at it.
Okay. I cannot finish this podcast without bringing this up.
Let's do it.
Uh-oh.
The AAP Kohl's collab. I just don't know what to think.
I think these things are meant to be divisive. They're meant to have these conversations about.
Oh, for sure. Where,
like, I think this is much less controversial divisive. In my mind than the Marvel ones.
Okay.
Which, like, I did not get, and people love. Which, talk about a lesson learned, right?
I understand the Marvel. I like kind of
what
I like.
Really?
I don't understand this. Sorry.
So Malaika, I feel like, I mean, we've already texted briefly about this, but I mean, I think I hold the polar opposite view where, I mean, and this is the guy that, you know, like I love everything Marvel. I love everything, you know, pop culture, but like the tourbillons, they felt a little maybe shoehorned in, as in it was just literally like, okay, do a character and place it in a tourbillon concept. Like for me, the thing that won me over with the cause is that this watch feels just so much more from the ground up as a singular piece. It doesn't feel like two, like a company and a licensing team came together and sort of was like, how do we make this work? No, like this call, like this expression, like it just works so well in the concept form. Like it's that like really like sort of metallic sort of heavy set and like that new peripheral like time display. Like it all just makes more sense to me and it feels more intentional. On the cause.
For sure. I think that makes sense if we're like analyzing product. Mm-hmm. I think if we're analyzing concept.
Uh-huh. I see. Yeah. I see where this is going.
I'm not on board. Sorry. And you know, everybody knows I'm a big AP fan. Mm-hmm. This one for me left me just dumbstruck because cultural relevance, if you're playing that card, then yes, Marvel again, like is ubiquitous, hands down. Travis Scott, despite what some of our readers may think, also ubiquitous. I get it. It's like you're taking the most popular thing and like, you know, doing that. Kohl's, I want to say, like, are we like a little bit late to Kohl's? Kind of strange to me.
Do you think the fact that like the public knows Kohl's now mostly because of like the Uniqlo stuff? Do you think that hurts it?
I just think Kohl's is a very like the Ike pod or however you say it. That to me makes sense. But that was like not this year. That was like when it was a moment. And I think the problem sometimes with the Swiss brands is that they, you know, I guess it takes a long time to develop a watch, but they're a little bit late to the game sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's why the ubiquitous stuff works so well, right? Because it will always be in the canon. Whereas the stuff that's super trendy, like it watches aren't fast enough. So like either you're going to be ahead and take a risk or you're going to be late culturally anyway.
And I know on the press release that they basically said the brand said like it took them 2 years to do this.
Yeah.
So like,
but yeah, even 2 years ago, I mean, cool. Yeah. This would have been sick in 2012. I understand from a product perspective. I just, from a AP sort of doing a really hard play on, you know, culture, I feel like they missed a little bit with this one.
As far as a watch goes, I think it's quite cool. But I obviously, like, I'm not deeply dialed into the world of art or the timing of, you know, causes peak popularity and that sort of thing. I think that this strategy of them taking the concept and applying totally non-watch impetus and inspiration is a really cool way of making 100 interesting watches for 100 people who, can you imagine how special it must be if you love Black Panther and you were able to get one, or if you love Cause and probably own some of his art otherwise, and you're able to get one of these? Like, that makes sense to me, even if I'm not the buyer for it.
Can I just argue this then? Because maybe I don't have a problem with the watch. Maybe I have a problem with the marketing. If you're going to be so splashy with the marketing, then it better be like something that is ubiquitous, like Marvel or Travis Scott or whatever. That's just my two cents. Sorry.
I think that's what we're looking for. We're looking to talk about what we thought of the watches and sort of the watch space in 2024. Collabs were a huge part of this. I think this is a topic that's going to come up in part two with Rich and Mark. And then probably, collabs is something we're already hearing about from brands for next year. Obviously, you can't give details, but there'll be lots to talk about in our future looking episodes, which will come out a little later this month. So for this episode of Hodinkee Radio, thank you so much for listening. And Tantan and Malaika, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really fun looking back at 2024.